Welcome back to Mein Kampf. Today we begin Volume 1, Chapter 4, Munich. And for those joining, this begins on page 83 of the PDF. In the spring of 1912, I moved to Munich for good. This was written by Hitler in 1924. The city was familiar to me, as if I'd lived within its walls for years. My studies were the reason for this, because they had repeatedly turned my attention toward German art. If you haven't seen Munich, you haven't seen Germany or German art. This time before the war was the happiest and by far the most contented of my life. My living was still meager, because I only painted enough to meet my living expenses, and so I could continue my studies. I believed that some day I would still reach the goal I had set for myself. This in itself made it easy for me to tolerate the small worries of daily life. I had a deep love that possessed me for this city ever since I first arrived, more than any other town I knew. It was a true German city. What a difference after Vienna! Thinking back to that corrupt Babylon-like city of races turned my stomach. The dialect in Munich was also much more natural to me. When I talked to the lower Bavarians, it reminded me of the days of my youth. There must have been a thousand things which were or became dear and precious to me in this city. I was most attracted by the wonderful mix of natural vigor and a fine artistic temper, the unique line from the architecture of the Hofbräuhaus, court brewery, to the music house, named the Odeon, and built by Ludwig I, and the September-October festival, Oktoberfest, we all know, to the beautiful art museum, Pinakothek, was also built by Ludwig I. Today, I am more attached to that city than any other spot in the world. No doubt partly because it is so firmly intertwined with the development of my own life. The happiness of true inner contentment that I enjoyed then could only be attributed to the magic spell that the wonderful capital of the Wittelsbach cast on every person. Wittelsbach is the name of the German-Bavarian royal dynasty. Visitors who are drawn there are clearly blessed with a sharp intelligence and with a sensitive spirit. Aside from my professional work, what attracted me the most was the study of the day's political events, especially matters of foreign policy. I was attracted to matters of foreign policy through the German alliance policy, which even in my Austrian days I had considered absolutely wrong. But in Vienna, I had not fully realized the extent of the German Empire's self-deception. I had been inclined to assume that people in Berlin knew how weak and unreliable their ally would actually be, but were withholding this knowledge for more or less mysterious reasons. At least, this is what I told myself. They might be trying to support an alliance policy, which Bismarck himself had originally introduced, and thought it was not a good idea to break it off suddenly. They may want to avoid arousing other foreign countries, which were lying in wait for their chance to strike, or perhaps it might alarm the citizenry at home. I was soon horrified to discover from my contacts that my belief was wrong. To my surprise, everywhere I looked, even the most well-informed circles were clueless about the nature of the Habsburg monarchy. The common people were especially victims of the idea that their ally could be considered a serious power that would support them in their hour of need. The masses still considered the monarchy a German state and thought they could depend on it. They believed that strength could be measured by the millions of people in Germany itself. They completely forgot that Austria had long since ceased to be a German state, and the inner structure of this empire was moving closer to dissolving by the hour. I understood this state structure better than the so-called official diplomacy did. As usual, they were spinning blindly toward disaster. The opinions of the people resulted from what had been poured into their heads by the leaders. But the leadership was nurturing a cult-like following of our ally, similar to the historical golden calf. They probably hoped to make up for the lack of honesty on the other side by being exceptionally friendly, so everything the other side told them was always taken at face value. In Vienna, I was furious when I saw the occasional difference between the speeches of the official statement and what was printed in the Vienna newspapers. Even then, Vienna at least appeared to still be a German city. The situation was totally different if one traveled from Vienna or German Austria into the Empire's Slavic provinces. A person only needed to look at the newspaper to see how the deception of the Triple Alliance was judged there. They had nothing but bloody sarcasm and contempt for this masterpiece of statesmanship. During this period of peace, while the two emperors kissed each other on the brow as a token of friendship, the people made no bones about the fact that they knew the alliance would soon collapse as soon as this glimmering glory of Nibelungen ideal was tested in reality. The reference to Nibelungen from Wagner's opera and Germanic mythology. Here it is a reference to a mythical royal family which was the supposed origin of some royal bloodlines or to the royals of that area. Nibelungen Lied is a really good book, by the way. The people were very unhappy for a few years later when the moment came for the alliance to prove itself, and Italy broke away from the Triple Alliance, leaving her two allies on their own. Italy then became an enemy herself. How the people ever believed for a moment such a miracle was possible, that Italy would fight on the same side with Austria, was absolutely incomprehensible to anyone not blinded by diplomacy. But the situation in Austria was identical. The sole support for the alliance in Austria came from the Habsburgs and the German Austrians. The Habsburgs supported it because it was in their own interests, and they had no choice. The Germans supported in good faith and out of political stupidity. The good faith of the Triple Alliance came from the fact that they thought they were doing the German Empire a great service by helping to strengthen and defend it. The political stupidity was because their belief was mistaken, and they were actually helping to chain the Reich to a dead state. This was bound to drag both into a bottomless pit, and most of all, this very alliance sacrificed them to the very efforts aimed at destroying German culture. The alliance gave the Habsburgs reason to believe that the German Empire would not interfere in their domestic affairs, which left them free to carry out their domestic policy of gradually eliminating the German element without risk. Not only were they shielded from any protest of the German government by the objectivity, but by referring to the alliance, they could always silence the dirty mouth of the Germans in Austria if it became too objectionable in its threats to stop some method being used to convert the area to a Slav region. After all, what could a German in Austria do when the German Reich itself expressed admiration and confidence for the Habsburg regime? Was he to resist and be branded as a traitor to his own nationality throughout the German-speaking world? He, who for decades had made the greatest sacrifices for his nationality? What value did the alliance have once the German elements in the Habsburg monarchy were exterminated? Was the value of the Triple Alliance for Germany not absolutely dependent upon the preservation of the German elements in Austria? Or did they really think they could live in an alliance with the Habsburg Empire of Slavs? The official attitude of German diplomacy, as well as that of the general public toward internal problems affecting the Austrian nationalities, was not merely stupid, it was insane. The alliance destroyed any level of security and erased the possibility that a nation of 70 million could continue to exist, while at the same time they allowed their partner to continue his policy of undermining the sole foundation of that alliance. Eventually, all that will remain is a formal contract with Vienna diplomats. The alliance itself would be useless, and Germany could never depend on the Allies for any form of support. Italy knew this from the beginning. If the people in Germany understood history and national psychology a bit more clearly, they never would have believed that the princes of Rome and the Vienna Habsburg, the Habsburgs is the imperial palace of the Austrian Habsburg royal family, would ever fight together. Italy herself would explode before the government would have dared send a single Italian to the battlefield for the hated Habsburg state, not unless the soldier was sent to fight against the Habsburgs. More than once in Vienna, I saw absolute contempt and unending hatred flare up between the Italians and the Austrian state, the sins of the House of Habsburg against Italian freedom and independence stretching over centuries was too great to be forgotten. This kind of hatred ran too deep. Neither the people nor the Italian government wanted to forget. For Austria, there were only two options available when it came to facing Italy, either alliance or war. By choosing alliance, she was able to take her time in preparing for the second. The German alliance was both senseless and dangerous, especially since Austria's relations with Russia came closer and closer to armed conflict. Here was a classic example of the total lack of deep or profound thinking in foreign policy. Why did they decide on an alliance at all? Well, was it only to assure a better future for Germany than she could manage with her own resources? But the future of Germany depended on the preservation of the German people's existence. So the question becomes, what position should the German nation take in the face of this predictable future, and how can we guarantee security for this development while living in the European balance of power? After carefully looking at the requirements for German stateship to be successful in foreign politics, we must come to the following conclusion. The yearly increase in Germany's population is almost 100,000 people. The difficulty of feeding this army of new citizens is bound to grow from year to year and will eventually end in catastrophe unless we find a means in time to avoid starvation. There were four ways to avoid this frightening development. 1. Using the French model, pregnancies could be aborted and therefore overpopulation avoided. It is totally true that in times of great trouble, bad climate conditions, or a poor crop yield, nature herself takes steps to limit a population's increase in certain countries or races. She does it both wisely and with no mercy. She does nothing to destroy actual reproduction, but prevents the survival of what is reproduced by exposing the new generation to such difficulties and deprivations that all the weaker and those that are less healthy are forced to die. Everything that nature allows to survive faces the trials of existence 1,000 times over, which makes life difficult, and only the well-equipped continue to reproduce. This allows the process of separating the good from the bad to start all over. By brutally and immediately eliminating the individual that can't handle the storms of life, she keeps the race and species strong and even pushes them to supreme achievement. Reducing the numbers creates stronger individuals and, in the end, improves the species. The result is different when man begins to limit his own number. He is not carved from the granite of nature, but wants to be humane. He believes he knows better than the cruel queen of all wisdom. He limits reproduction itself, not the survival of the individual. He always sees himself as an individual and never as the race. He believes this road is more humane and better justified. Unfortunately, the results are also reversed. Nature puts a severe test upon survival while allowing free reproduction, then chooses the best among a lot of individual creatures to remain alive and propagate their species. Man, on the other hand, restricts breeding, but takes frantic care that every creature that is born will survive at any cost. This correction of divine purpose seems wise and humane to him, and he is delighted to have outwitted nature and proven her inadequacy. The Heavenly Father's pet ape hates to acknowledge the fact that the individual's value is reduced when their numbers are restricted. The moment reproduction is restricted and the number of births reduced, we have a craving at any cost to save even the weakest and most sickly instead of allowing the strongest and healthiest to survive naturally. The seeds of a new generation are bound to become more and more pitiful the longer this mockery of nature and her will continues. If this policy continues, the nation will eventually terminate its own existence on the earth. Man may defy the eternal laws of nature's procreation for a short time, but vengeance will follow sooner or later. A stronger race will push aside the the one which has grown weak. The divine will shatters all the absurd chains of this so-called humane consideration for the individual and replaces it with the humanity of nature. She has no hesitation and wipes out what is weak in order to give a rightful place to the strong. Anyone who attempts to assure a people's existence by limiting birth rates is simply robbing the nation of its future. 2. A second way of avoiding a frightful future might be the one we constantly hear recommended today, internal colonization. Those who suggest this idea mean well, but they don't have a clue what they are talking about, and this would ultimately cause the greatest harm that could be imagined. Without a doubt, the yield of certain areas of soil can be increased. However, this is only possible within certain limits and cannot continue indefinitely. For a time, the increase in the number of German people can be balanced by increased crop production without the danger of starvation. But, ultimately, the demands made on life will increase faster than the population. People's requirements for food and clothing grow from year to year, and that cannot even be compared to the meager needs of our forefathers, say, 100 years ago. In other words, it is a mistake to believe that increases in productivity make an increase in population possible. No, this is only true to a certain extent, since at least part of the increased crop production must go to satisfy the increased needs of men, even the great sacrifice on one hand and constantly running industry on the other. The earth itself is bound to set a limit. All the diligence in the world can't squeeze any more out of it. Disaster still comes, even if it is somewhat delayed. For a while, starvation will only happen occasionally, when crops fail or something of that sort occurs, but as the number of people increase, it will come more and more often until the only time it doesn't happen is when the bumper crops fill the grain storehouses. Finally, the time comes when the pain can no longer be alleviated and starvation is constant. Now, nature must come to the rescue again and decide who will live, or else man resorts to artificial restriction to slow the population increase. Some may still believe that sooner or later this future must come over the world, and as part of nature, no one can escape it. At first glance, this is absolutely true. Nevertheless, we must consider the following. Someday, balancing the crop production with the population growth will be impossible and will force all mankind to stop expanding the human race. Either they will have to leave the decision to nature or strike the necessary balance by solving the problem themselves, but by a method better than those available today. This will be true for all people, while now only those races that no longer have the strength and energy to assure themselves of the land they need in this world are in trouble. At present, large areas of land still exist in the world that are being unused and just waiting to be broken by a cultivator. It is also true, however, that nature is not holding this land in reserve for the future of a particular nation or race. This land is for the people who have the strength to take it and the diligence to till it. Nature knows no political boundaries. She simply deposits life on this globe and watches what happens. The boldest and most industrious of her children become her favorite, and is made the lord over creation. If a group of people confines itself to internal colonization, while other races are grabbing greater areas, their options will be limited when the other races can constantly increase in number. Someday this will happen, and the smaller the people's living space, the sooner it will be. The best nations, which are the only truly civilized races, decide in their pacifist blindness to make no effort to expand their land and are content with internal colonization, while inferior nations succeed in taking large livable areas of the world. A smaller and densely populated territory may be better from the cultural standpoint of these less ruthless races, which are limited by land and restricted in their population's growth, but people of lower civilizations, which are simple-minded and cruel, would still be able to increase without limit because of all their territory. In other words, the world will someday be dominated by the culturally inferior but more energetic part of humanity. Niggers! Someday in the future, there will be two possible outcomes. Either the world will be governed according to the ideas of our modern democracy, and the equality of every decision will lie with the more numerous races, or the world will be ruled by the natural laws of relative strength, and the people possessing brutal willpower will triumph over the nations that have denied themselves what they need to survive. There is no doubt that the world will someday be the scene of huge battles for the existence of mankind. In the end, the craving for self-preservation alone will triumph. That stupid and cowardly group of humanity that thinks they know more than everyone else will find their humanitarianism melts like snow in the March sun when they face destruction. In eternal battle, mankind can find greatness. In eternal peace, it will find destruction. For Germans, the slogan of internal colonization is damnation. If for no other reason, it immediately confirms the belief that we have found a peaceful existence that allows us to lead a gentle, dreamlike life by working for our living. If we ever took this idea seriously, it would mean the end of any effort to maintain our rightful place in the world. Let the average German become convinced that his life in future can be guaranteed, and it will extinguish any effort to protect German vital necessities. If the whole nation took this attitude, we could regard any useful foreign policy as dead and buried along with the German people. It is not an accident that the Jew is the one who first plants such deadly ideas among our people. He knows his wimps too well not to realize that they will be willing victims of any swindler who tells them he can snap his fingers, causing nature to jump to attention, and that he can alleviate the hard struggle for existence while still allowing them to ascend to lordship over the planet, working only when a pleasing chance presents itself, but mostly by it just happening. I cannot emphasize enough that all German internal colonization must serve primarily to correct social abuses by those who do not make good use of the land, especially by withdrawing the land from public control, which prevents its use, or to release it from the grasp of speculators who only buy it without using it. But internal colonization can never adequately assure the future of the nation without acquiring new land. If we follow any other path, we will soon be at the end of our territory, as well as at the end of our strength. If we pursue internal colonization alone, we will soon reach a point beyond which the resources of our soil can no longer sustain us, and at the same time, we will reach a point beyond which our manpower cannot expand. The size of a people's home territory is an important factor in its outer security. The greater the space at people's disposal, the greater their natural protection. The decision to use more military force can be made more quickly, more easily, more effectively, and more completely against people who live in small, restricted territories, but such force cannot be used so easily against the same people occupying a larger territory. The large size of a state's territory does offer a certain protection against offhanded attacks, because any battle would require a long and intense struggle. The risk involved in a malicious assault will seem too great unless there are extraordinary reasons for it. That is to say, the very size of a state allows its people to more easily preserve its freedom and independence. But on the other hand, a small country invites an invader. The first two options for striking a balance between the rising population and the fixed amount of land were opposed by so-called nationalist circles in Germany. The reason for this attitude were different from those just given. When the idea was proposed, people were hostile to the idea of limiting births, mostly because of their morals. They indignantly condemned the internal colonization because they felt it was an attack against the great landowners and saw this as the beginning of a general attack against ownership of private property. Considering the way the second doctrine of salvation was supported, they were probably exactly right in their assumption. As far as the great masses were concerned, the defense was not very skillful and in no way reached the heart of the problem. Now there were only two ways of remaining that could assure the rising population would receive their fill of work and bread. One, either new land could be acquired, purchased or taken, that would support the extra millions year by year and keep the nation of self-sustaining, or keep the nation self-sustaining. Or two, industry and commerce could focus on producing goods for export and extract a living from the profits. In other words, use a territorial or colonial and commercial expansion policy. These options were reviewed from various angles, discussed, argued, and opposed, until finally, the option of internal colonization was definitely followed. The more solid decision would have been one that was not properly considered, the third, expansion. Additional new land for the overflowing population has countless advantages, particularly if we look to the future and not just at the present. Preserving a healthy farming class as the cornerstone of the whole nation can never be overvalued. Many of our current troubles result from the unsound relationship between country and city people. A solid nucleus of small and medium-scale peasant farmers has always been the best protection against the kinds of social issues we have today. This is the only solution which allows a nation to obtain its daily bread through its domestic economy. Industry and commerce would withdraw from their unhealthy position of leadership and take their places in the general scheme of a nationally balanced consumption economy. They are no longer the basis of the nation's livelihood, but only an aid to it. By confining themselves to this balanced role between home production and consumption in every field, they make everyone's livelihood more or less independent of foreign countries, and help to assure the freedom of the state and the independence of the nation, especially in times of stress. It has to be said that this territorial policy cannot be carried out in a place like the African Cameroons, but almost without exception will have to take place in Europe. We coolly and calmly realize there is no way it can be the intention of heaven to give one group of people 50 times as much of the world's soil as another group controls. We must not let political frontiers distract us from the frontiers of eternal justice. If this earth really has room for everyone, we should have under our feet the land we need to exist. No one will give up land willingly. But here, the law of self-preservation comes into play, and what is denied in peaceful friendship must be taken by force. If our forefathers had made their decisions using the same pacifist nonsense we see today, we would only possess a third of our existing territory. There would barely be any German people left to suffer in Europe. No, we owe our existence to the natural determination to fight for our own survival, which gained us the two eastern boundaries of the empire, the Ostmark areas bordering Poland. This inner strength has gained us a large state and territory for our race, which alone has allowed us to survive to the present day. There is another reason this is the correct solution. Many European states today are like inverted pyramids. The territory of some European countries is ridiculously small compared to their load of colonies and their level of foreign trade, etc. We can correctly say that the apex is in Europe and the base is all over the world. In contrast, the American Union's base is still on its own continent and the only apex touches the rest of the earth. The enormous strength of the American state comes from their size, and the reverse is true for most European colonial powers, which contributes to their weakness. England does not disprove this because in front of the British Empire we have a vast community linked by a common language and culture throughout the world. Because of its linguistic and cultural ties with the American Union, England's position cannot be compared with that of any other state in Europe. For Germany, the only territorial policy was acquiring new land in Europe itself. Colonies are useless for this purpose, unless they are suitable for large-scale settlement by Europeans. In the 19th century, that sort of colonial territory could no longer be obtained by peaceful means. Any attempt at a colonial expansion outside of Europe would have required a large military effort. It would have been more practical to undertake that military struggle in Europe and gather land there instead of spreading abroad. A decision of this magnitude requires absolute, single-minded devotion once it is made. There must be no half-hearted efforts or hesitation in attacking a task which can be can only be achieved by using every last ounce of strength. The political leadership of the empire must be devoted exclusively to this purpose. Everything done must be done to accomplish this task without distractions. The goal could only be achieved by force, and that knowledge should be taken to the battle with determination, peace, and calm. Any alliance with another country should have been considered and assessed based on its usefulness from this standpoint alone. If European soil was the objective, it could be acquired primarily at the expense of Russia. The new empire must once again march the road to the ancient knights of the German order and use the sword to provide land for the German plow, which can then provide our daily bread. For this kind of policy, there was only one ally in Europe, England. Only with England covering our rear could we have begun a new Germanic migration. Our justification would have been as strong as our forefathers. None of our pacifists refuse to eat food from the East, and they ignore the fact that the first plowshare there was actually a sword. No sacrifice should have been too great to win England's friendship. We should have given up all thought of colonies and sea power and avoided competition with British industry if that is what was needed. Only absolute clear-sightedness could bring success along with abandoning world trade, colonies, and a German navy. The state's power must be totally concentrated on the army. The result would have been a temporary setback, but a great and mighty future. There was a time when we could have discussed this plan with England. England understood very well that Germany had a growing population with growing needs. Those needs would be filled either with England as an ally in Europe or another ally in the world. At the turn of the century, London itself tried to establish a relationship with Germany. For the first time, people were upset, thinking we might have to pull England's chestnuts out of the fire. This attitude was unfortunate and caused them to act as if an alliance did not require mutual give and take. Such a deal could easily have been made with England. British diplomacy was at least smart enough to know that nothing can be expected without something in return. If a wise German foreign policy had taken over Japan's role in 1904, in the Russo-Japan War, also called the Manchurian Campaign, where Japan was victorious over Russia and gained large territories, we can hardly grasp the impact that it would have for Germany. Things would never have reached the point of the First World War. The bloodshed in 1904 would have saved bloodshed in 1914 to 1918 by 10 times. And what a position Germany would hold in the world today! The alliance with Austria would then have been nonsense. This dead state was only allied with Germany to preserve a continued peace, which could be cleverly used for the show, but sure extermination of German culture in the monarchy. The alliance could never have been used to fight a war. If for no other reason, this alliance was impossible because there were no German national interests to uphold. How could we expect a state that did not have the strength and determination to put an end to the destruction of German culture on its own frontier to be a true ally in time of war? If Germany didn't have enough national common sense or ruthlessness to maintain control over the fate of 10 million of its own race and protect them from the Habsburg state, it could not be expected to take on such a daring and future-focused plan. The attitude of the old German Empire toward the Austrian problem might have been seen as a test of its stamina where the destinies of the whole nation were at stake. In any case, they had no business watching idly while German culture was whittled away year after year. The value of Austria's alliance depended totally on the preservation of the German element in Austria, but they made no effort to preserve or protect our people. They feared falling into a struggle more than anything and were finally forced into battle at the worst time. They hoped to flee fate and were overtaken by it. They dreamed of preserving world peace and ended up in world war. Here is the main reason the expansion necessary for a German future was not even considered. They knew that the acquisition of new territory could only be accomplished by going east through Russia. They understood the battle that would be necessary, and they wanted peace at any price. The song of German foreign policy had long since changed from preservation of the German nation by every means to preservation of world peace by any means. How well they succeeded, everyone knows. I will have more to say on that subject later. Then there was the fourth possibility. Industry and world trade, sea power, and colonies. At the beginning, this development was easier and quicker to achieve. True colonization of territory, however, is a slow process and often takes centuries. Indeed, the strength of colonies results from the fact that they take a long time to build and are not the result of a sudden burst of energy like industrial growth. Industrial growth bursts can be built within a few years. Unfortunately, the industrial result is not of great quality, but is frail, more like a soap bubble. It is much easier to build quickly than to follow through with the difficult task of settling a territory with farmers and establishing farms. It is also true that the easy path is more quickly destroyed than a slow one. When Germany chose to maintain peace at any cost, she had to realize that this choice would lead to battle someday. Only children could expect pleasant and mannerly behavior, and a constant emphasis on peaceful intentions would give them their bananas in the peaceful competition of nations. These people talked as if they were groveling diplomats hoping war would never come. No, if we took this road, someday England was bound to be our enemy. Our innocent assumptions fit nicely with pacifism, but it was silly to resent the day England would violently oppose what they saw as an attempted expansion. Obviously, they would enforce their self-interests. Of course, we would never have done such a thing. How could we protect our self-interests with pacifists at the helm? A European territorial expansion policy could be carried on strictly against Russia and in league with England as our ally. On the other hand, if we allied with Russia against England, then a colonial and world trade policy would be possible against England and her colonies was only with the support of Russia. In that case, the most important conclusion must be drawn here, that Austria must be sent packing at once. Considered from any angle, the alliance with Austria was sheer madness, even by the turn of the century. Germany never dreamed of allying with Russia against England, and any more than siding with England against Russia, because in either case, the result would have been war. It was only to avoid war that the commercial and industrial policy was chosen in the first place. By using the peaceful economic conquest of the world policy, they thought they would break the neck of old policy of force once and for all. There may have been some doubts about Germany's conviction to this policy, particularly when England began to utter incomprehensible threats. We then responded by building a navy. However, this navy was not meant to attack and annihilate England, but to defend the world peace and the peaceful conquest of the world. The fleet was kept within modest limits, not just in the number and size of vessels, but in armament. These limits were set as proof that our intentions were merely to maintain peace. The fine talk about peaceful economic conquests of the world was probably the greatest nonsense ever included in a guiding principle of state policy. The nonsense was made even worse by the fact that people pointed to England as an example of how this type of conquest was possible. Our path in the teaching and concept of history was the reason for this error, and is the most striking proof of how many people learn history without even understanding it. People should have recognized England as the most crushing disproof of the theory. No people have ever used the sword more brutally in the service of its economic conquests, or more ruthlessly defended them afterward than the English. It is not the most characteristic feature of British diplomacy to obtain economic gain from political power and then to turn around and immediately transform every economic advance into political strength. What a mistake to think that England was too cowardly to back up its economic policy with its own blood. The fact that the English people lacked a national army was no proof. This was not a question of the form of their military, but of the will and determination to exert whatever force is needed. England always had the armament she needed. She always fought with the weapons that were necessary for success. She fought with mercenaries as long as mercenaries were enough. She dipped deep into the best blood of the whole nation when such a sacrifice was essential to bring victory. But the determination for the struggle and the stubbornness and brutality with which it was conducted always remained the same. The German schools, press, and comic books gradually created an image of the Englishman and his empire, which was bound to lead to fatal self-deception. Everyone was gradually affected by this nonsense, and the result was to underestimate our enemy, for that we paid dearly. The misrepresentation was so overwhelming that people firmly believed the Englishman was a businessman whose sharp negotiation skill was equaled only by his incredible personal weakness. Unfortunately, it did not occur to our dignified teachers and dispensers of wisdom that a world empire the size of England's could not be built by stealing and swindling. The few men who sounded a warning were ignored or met with a conspiracy of silence. I can still remember the astonishment on my comrades' faces when we clashed in person with the Tommies, English soldiers, in Flanders. After the first few days of battle, it began to dawn on everyone that these Scotsmen were not the men they had been led to believe and were not like the ones depicted in comic books and newspaper articles. That was when I first began to understand some of the most useful forms of propaganda. These false representations had one advantage for its perpetrators. The example could be used to show that the economic conquest of the world was a sound idea. If the Englishman could do it, so could we. Our greater honesty and the lack of treachery which was so English in itself was considered a great advantage to us. People hoped to win sympathy from the smaller nations as well as the confidence of the great ones. Because we took it all seriously, we never dreamed that our honesty was an outrage to the rest of the world. They considered our behavior an extremely cunning form of dishonesty. It was not until our revolution that they realized our honest intentions were sincere to a point beyond stupidity, which they no doubt found astonishing. Only this rubbish of peaceful economic conquest of the world could make the foolishness of the Triple Alliance clear and understandable. What other state could Germany possibly become allies with? They could not obtain territory from any state in Europe when allied with Austria. This was the inside weakness of the alliance from the beginning. Bismarck could allow this as a temporary solution, but that did not mean every inexperienced successor should do the same, especially in an age when the basis of Bismarck's alliance had long ago since ceased to exist. Bismarck still believed, in his time, that Austria was a German state, but with the gradual introduction of the general right to vote, the country had sunk to a parliament-controlled, un-German state of confusion. As a matter of brief policy, the alliance with Austria was also disastrous. The growth of a new, strong Slavic power was tolerated right on the borders of the empire. They should have seen that the attitude of this power toward Germany would sooner or later be very different from that of Russia. At the same time, the alliance itself was bound to grow empty and weak from year to year because the sole supporters of the idea lost influence in the monarchy and were crowded out of the most influential positions. By the turn of the century 1900, Germany's alliance with Austria had reached the same stage as Austria's alliance with Italy. We had to make a choice. Either side with the Austrian Habsburg monarchy, or openly protest the oppression of German culture in Austria. Once a decision of this sort is made, it usually ends in open battle. Even psychologically, the Triple Alliance had only a modest value since the strength of an alliance declines as soon as it begins to limit itself to preserving an existing situation. On the contrary, if an alliance increases in strength when it offers both parties the hope of territorial expansion. It is true everywhere that strength is not in the defense, but in the attack. This was recognized in many places, but unfortunately not in the so-called competent circles of elected officials. Colonel Ludendorff, officer on the Great General Staff at the time pointed to these weaknesses in a paper written in 1912. Of course, the other statesmen attached no value or importance to the situation. Clear common sense is apparently only needed for ordinary mortals, and it can always be dispensed with in the case of diplomats. Germany was lucky that Austria was the cause of the war in 1914. This required the Habsburgs to participate. If war had come from the other direction, Germany would have been alone. The Habsburg state could never have taken part, or even wanted to take part, in a struggle started by Germany. If Germany was the cause of war, Austria would have done what Italy was later so loudly condemned for doing. It would have remained neutral in order to at least protect the state from a revolution at the very start. The Austrian Slavs would rather have broken up the monarchy in 1914 than offer to help Germany. Very few people at the time realized how great the dangers were or the added problems that the alliance with the monarchy brought with it. In the first place, Austria had too many enemies who hoped to inherit the decaying state. During that time, Germany was bound to be exposed to some hatred because Germany was the obstruction to the dismemberment of the monarchy, which was almost universally desired. In the end, nations came to the conclusion that Vienna could only be reached by way of Berlin. In the second place, Germany lost its best and most promising chance of forming an alliance with another country. Instead, tensions increased with Russia and with Italy. The general feelings in Rome toward Germany were favorable and equally hostile towards Austria, but tensions still built against Germany politically. Since the commercial and industrial expansion policy had been established, there was no longer any reason for Germany to struggle with Russia. Only the enemies of both Germany and Russia could have any real interest in a conflict between them. In fact, it was chiefly Jews and Marxists who used every way they could think of to stir up war between the two states. Third and lastly, the alliance concealed one huge threat to Germany. Any great power that was hostile to Bismarck's empire could easily mobilize a whole string of states against Germany by promising spoils at the expense of the Austrian ally. All of Eastern Europe, especially Russia and Italy, could have been raised up against Austria and the monarchy. The world coalition started by King Edward would never have happened if Germany's ally, Austria, had not been an irresistibly tempting prize. This promise was the only way to unite these states that otherwise had such varied desires and goals. In a general advance against Germany, everyone could hope to benefit at the expense of Austria. The danger was actually even greater because Turkey also seemed to belong to this unlucky alliance as a silent partner. The forces behind international Jewish world finance needed this bait in order to carry out its long-cherished plan of destroying Germany. At this time, Germany had not yet given in to general international control because of its finance and economic structure. It was the only way to forge a coalition which would be strong and bold enough and would have the numbers of marching millions, which could battle with the armored skin of Siegfried at last. A Wagner opera reference where Siegfried bathes in the blood of a dragon, which forms scales on him as a protection, similar to Achilles. Here Siegfried is another name for the Germanic race. Even in Austria, I was completely unhappy with the Habsburg monarchy alliance, and it was now the subject of a long inward analysis which ended by confirming my earlier opinion even more strongly. In the humble circles in which I moved, I didn't hide my conviction that this unhappy treaty was with a state marked for destruction, and it must lead to a catastrophic collapse of Germany too if we did not get out in time. My solid conviction never wavered, even when the storm of the First World War seemed to have cut off all sensible thinking and the flood of enthusiasm had swept away those who could coldly look at reality with total objectivity. Whenever I heard these problems discussed, even while I was at the front, I maintained my opinion that the alliance must be broken off, and the sooner the better for the German nation. It would be no sacrifice at all to deliver up the Habsburg monarchy if Germany could limit the number of her adversaries. Millions strapped on the steel helmet to save the German nation, not to preserve a wicked dynasty. Once or twice before the war, at least one camp would have some doubts about the soundness of the alliance policy. From time to time, German conservative circles began to warn about being too trusting. Their warnings were ignored, along with all other common sense. People were convinced they were on the high road to a world conquest. All they could see was the enormous chance of success without any cost whatsoever. Once again, there was nothing for the average man to do but watch in silence while the elected officials marched the country straight into damnation, with the good folk following after them like rats, following the Pied Piper of Hamelin. The Pied Piper of Hamelin is the subject of a Middle Ages legend where he led a great many children from the town of Hamelin, Germany, to their death after he was not paid for his services, leading rats away from the town. Doy. The general state of our entire political thinking was the main reason it was possible to make a group of people accept the nonsense of economic conquest as a political goal, and this same weak thinking caused them to accept the preservation of world peace as a political goal. With the victorious march of German industry and invention and the growing success of German trade, people could no longer see that the whole thing was based on the assumption that the state was strong. In many circles, people went so far as to argue that the state itself owed its existence solely to the industry, and that the state was primarily an economic institution which should be governed based on economic interests. They thought its existence depended on the economic life, a condition which was praised as the healthiest and most natural form of being. This is wrong. The state has nothing whatsoever to do with any particular economic concept or development. The state is not a union of economic contrasting parties within a definite limited area to perform economic tasks. It is the organization of a community, a collection of physically and spiritually similar people who, together, make the preservation of their species possible, as well as the accomplishment of the goal which Providence has set for their existence. That, and that alone, is the purpose and meaning of a state. The economic system is one of the many methods needed to reach the goal. It can never be the purpose of a state unless it is set up on an incorrect and unnatural basis from the beginning. That explains why a state should not assume any territorial limitations as a requirement of its founding. Expansion is necessary for people who want to ensure their species continues with their own resources and who are ready to fight in order to live from their own efforts. People who succeed in sneaking in among the rest of mankind like loafers, letting the others work for them while making all kinds of excuses, can form states without any definite living boundaries on their own. This is especially true of those people that the rest of honest humanity is suffering from today, the blood-sucking Jews. The Jewish state has never been limited by space. Their one race has universally unlimited territory. Therefore, these people have always formed a state within a state. It is one of the most brilliant tricks ever invented to have the state sail under the colors of a religion. The tolerance by the Aryan is assured because he is always ready to make allowances for a religious group. The Mosaic Law religion, commonly known as Halacha, which is the collective body of Jewish law, is nothing but a doctrine for the preservation of the Jewish race. This is why it includes almost every field of sociological, political, and economic knowledge that could possibly serve that purpose. The instinct for preservation of the species is the original reason for the formation of human communities. The state is a race-oriented organization and not an economic organization. As great as the difference is between them, it is still totally incomprehensible to the statesmen of today. They think they can build up the state by purely economic means, but in reality, the state comes from the will of a species and a race to survive. These qualities are always heroic traits and never the ego of the businessman. After all, the survival of a species depends on its willingness to sacrifice the individual. The words of the poet, "And if you do not stake your lives, life shall never be your prize," quoted from the song Cuirassiers in Schiller's Wallenstein, signify that giving up personal existence is necessary to assure the survival of the species. The most essential requirement for the formation and maintenance of a state is a community of similar character and a species who believe in that community and are willing to back it up by whatever means are necessary. People protecting their own soil become heroes. With parasites, it is different. It leads to lying, hypocrisy, and malicious cruelty. The initial formation of a state can only take place by applying these heroic qualities. In the resulting struggle for self-preservation, some people who lack these qualities will fall victim to the parasites and become economic slaves who will be defeated and eventually die. These are not heroes. They can't resist the methods of the hostile parasites. But even here, it is almost never a lack of wisdom, but more a lack of courage and determination which tries to hide under the cloak of humane principles. There is only the slightest connection between economics and state building and state preserving. This is best demonstrated by the inner state strength of a state, which only rarely coincides with its economic success. We can also find countless examples that show prosperity is a sign of approaching decline. If the formation of human communities were primarily for economic forces, strong development would mean the greatest strength of a state and not the other way around. Faith in the state-building or state-preserving power of economics is particularly hard to understand when it holds influence in a country that clearly demonstrates the opposite from its history. Prussia wonderfully proved that ideals and virtues alone make the creation of a state possible, and not material qualities. Only under their protection can economic life flourish. When the elements that were responsible for state building collapse, the economic structure also topples. This is a process we are now seeing in a sad way. The material interests of mankind always flourish best when they are shadowed by heroic virtues, but when economics attempt to take center stage, they destroy the essential part of their own existence. Whenever a strong political power has existed in Germany, economic life has always progressed. Whenever the economic system has become the only substance of our people's life, it smothered the virtues of idealism, and the state collapsed and carried the economic benefits with it into the ground. If we ask ourselves what forces preserve a state, we can lump them all in one category: the ability and willingness of an individual to sacrifice himself for the whole. These virtues have nothing at all to do with economics. We can see this from the simple fact that man never sacrifices himself for economics. People don't die for business, but for ideals. Nothing showed more clearly the Englishman's superior ability to look into the psychology and into the soul of his people than the motivation he demonstrated in this struggle. While we were battling for bread, English was fighting for freedom, and it was freedom for the little nations, not even for herself. We laughed and were annoyed by this audacity. We showed the same thoughtless stupidity the German statesmen demonstrated so well before the war. Men lost the desire to die of their own free will. As long as the German people in 1914 still believed they were fighting for ideals, the battle continued. When they were told to fight for economic survival, they gave up. When something finds itself fighting simply for the production of daily bread, it prefers to give up. Our intelligent statesmen were astonished at this change in public sentiment. Never understood that from the moment a man begins to fight for an economic interest, he avoids the death that would prevent him from ever enjoying the rewards for his struggle. The most delicate mother becomes a heroine to save her own child. The battle for the preservation of the species and of the home or state that sheltered it is what always made men willing to go to war. We offer the following as an eternal truth. No state has ever been created by establishing a peaceful economy. Only through the instincts that preserve the species, whether they are heroic virtue or shrewdness, have states been created. Heroic virtue produces the true Aryan, working civilized states, while shrewdness produces Jewish parasite colonies. When instincts in a race or a state are overrun by economics, the economic structure itself releases the causes that lead to defeat and oppression. The belief before the First World War was that Germany could open up or even conquer the world through peaceful colonial means, and commercial policy was a sign that the state-building and state-preserving virtues had been lost. Also lost was the insight, strength of will, and determination needed to take decisive action. The law of nature brought the First World War and its results as revenge upon our heads. Anyone who failed to look below the surface would only see an unsolvable puzzle when considering this universal attitude of the German nation. After all, Germany herself was the most wonderful example of an empire created by power and military valor. Prussia, the nucleus of the empire, was created by brilliant courage, not by financial operations or business deals. The empire was missing the magnificent reward of a leadership based on power politics and based on the courage to risk death. How could the political instincts of the Germans become so diseased? This was not a one-time occurrence, but a matter of destructive forces in frightening numbers that spread among the people and attacked the nation like a cancerous ulcer. It seemed as if a constant stream of poison was being injected by some mysterious unseen power into the very blood vessels of what had once been a hero's body. As this poison spread, it crippled common sense and the simple instinct of self-preservation. My attitude toward the German economic policy and Triple Alliance policy from 1912 to 1914 forced me to review these questions over and over. Through the process of elimination, I found the solution to the puzzle. It was a power which I had already come to know in Vienna from a different standpoint. The source of the problem was the Marxist doctrine and their resulting actions throughout the nation. For the second time in my life, I dug into this doctrine of destruction. This time I was guided by my observations of what was happening in the nation's political life and not by the impressions and effect of my daily surroundings. I became absorbed again in the theoretical literature of this new world and tried to understand its possible consequences. I compared these with the actual events and their effects in political, cultural, and economic life. For the first time, I also devoted my attention to those efforts made to stop this plague. I started the purpose, struggle for, and effort of Bismarck's emergency legislation. Bismarck passed laws in 1878 to curb social democrat and Marxist activities. Gradually, I laid a rock-solid foundation for my own belief and have never had to revise my views on the issue. I also examined the connection between Marxism and Jewry more closely. While in Vienna, I had believed Germany was an unshakable colossus, but now uneasy doubts began to build in me. In my own mind, and in the small circle of my acquaintances, I argued German foreign policy and discussed what I believed to be the incredibly negligent treatment of the most important problem that then existed in Germany at the time, Marxism. I really could not understand how they could stagger so blindly toward a horrible danger whose aims were clearly and openly discussed by the leaders of Marxism. Among my acquaintances, then and now, I warned against the smooth-talking, soothing slogan of all cowardly wretches who said, "Nothing can happen to us." A similar troublesome attitude had destroyed one giant empire already. Did everyone believe Germany alone was going to be exempt from the laws that governed all other societies? In 1913 and 1914, I announced my conviction that the future of all Germans depended on destroying Marxism. Some of the circles where I spoke are now faithfully part of the National Socialist movement today. In the destructive German Triple Alliance policy, I saw the result of the Marxist doctrine's destructive hand. The fearful teachings of this poison almost invisibly destroyed every foundation of a healthy economic policy and every healthy state concept. This occurred in such a way that the victims who were contaminated did not even realize the acts and desires that resulted were actually part of a world concept which they were otherwise strongly against. The inner decline of the German people started long before they recognized the destroyer of their existence was growing among them. Now and then, there was some treatment of the disease, but the symptoms were too often confused with the cause. As people did not or would not look at the cause, the struggle against Marxism was as effective as a long-winded quack's miracle cure.